back to the teaching on training by abstinence. Spirituality may be called a capacity. This is what our friends here have said, that kind of container would make a capacity. Plainly explained, it may be called depth. Spirituality may be called a capacity. Plainly explained, it may be called depth. In some people, naturally, there is this capacity, this depth. And in some, it may be made. In order to collect the rainwater, people dig the ground and make a capacity for the water to collect. So in order to receive the spiritual life and light, one must open oneself a capacity. In order to collect the rainwater, people dig the ground and make a capacity for the water to collect. So, in order to receive the spiritual life and light, one must open oneself a capacity. Now, one must open it oneself, or perhaps working with a spiritual mentor that can be opened for you. Not always in ways that you maybe like. Remind you of the story, of the Rumi story of the chickpea, yeah? And the sheikh, you remember that story?
No.
Oh my God, that's a great story. So the chickpea, I'm paraphrasing because I don't have the text here, but it's a beautiful Jalaluddin Rumi poem where the chickpea is in the boiling pot and crying. And the sheikh has the ladle. Boink! Boink! Bopping the chickpea back into the boiling pot. And the chickpea's crying out, "Why are you doing this to me?" And the sheikh, or the teacher, "Boink! Get back in there. I'm not done with you yet. You think that all of this life is just for your pleasure? I'm making a real human being out of you. First the water, then the growth, then the herbs and the spices. Get in that pot." So, you know, sometimes you're getting a little bit of the school of hard knocks, but we can learn from those things, yes? And life, I tell you, will give it to you irregardless. We may resist it, but if we practice patience, being self-contained in our patience, perhaps there's a lesson that's being given, and we can learn from it. You know what I'm talking about, a chickpea? They're very hard, little nuggets, unless they get softened, right? Yeah, that's right. Boink, 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 boink. So one of the ways that we can soften these, maybe even kind of like thought forms that we get confused, are through spiritual practice. And one of the methods that Sufis use is mantra yoga. We might call it wazifa. Mirsha has called it mantra shastra. I'm going to read now a little bit about that because it's very important to understand the effect that these sounds and vibrations have on us. That they shouldn't just be, thoughtless. One can feel the vibration very deeply if one don't necessarily think the number of wazifa or repetitions is important as the depth. Again, the depth. And so here again, I want to talk just a little bit though about this depth, making this capacity, because it's as if one's chalice is full, there's nothing else that can go in. But if it's completely empty, it can be really filled. Delicious wine, so to speak, of the beloved. So we're always trying to make this accommodation, you could say. This is not my body, this is the temple of God. There is nothing, only God is. not me, but thee. Before I move on, may I ask, are there any comments or questions? This can be from the group here, or if anyone online has anything to say, please feel free to type that in. We're here to listen.
But I would like to say a note from earlier that Ananda had put in, just okay. If you could, if we could move the mic closer. But as she wrote it, you started speaking louder, and so...
It was okay.
I hope it's okay, Ananda. Please let us know. Microphone closer would still be my request. Ever so sorry.
I'll just try to speak louder. Yeah. And we're using another computer that I'm not familiar with, so I'm not sure if the settings are quite right. But if I speak up, is that helpful to you?
Yes, a bit better. Thanks a lot.
Should we try to adjust something here? Okay. Then I will make my best effort to speak louder. Thank you. And before I begin the reading on Wazifa, I'd like to just give you one quote by Hiramursha Hazrat Anayat Khan, and this is from the Vedan. And it, again, is a very pithy way of making this teaching very clear to us. And I'll try to move a little closer here. It's okay, thank you. I'm okay. I'll just sit forward. Thank you. And the quote is, "To express an impulse gives relief, but to control it gives strength." To express an impulse gives relief, but to control it gives strength. So, Sharif and Halima, when you were talking about the idea of power or containment, we could also replace that word power with strength. It gives us strength. You know, it's like controlling something, holding it, you know, it gives us strength. It gives us endurance. So here on the subject of Wazifa, I am reading from the Sufi Message Volume Number 4, the volume titled The Mayan World, and it is on the subject of Wazifa by Hazrat Anayat Khan. I've only taken a part of the teachings in each instance, but it gives us a background of what we're about to do in terms of a practice. A thought may be compared with a moving picture projected upon a curtain. It is not one picture, but it is several parts of this picture that, changing every moment, complete the picture. And so it is with the thought. Everybody does not always hold a picture in his mind. As a rule, a person makes a picture by a gradual process of completing it. In other words, the thought picture is made in parts. And when the thought is completed, the parts meet to form one picture. This gives the idea of why it's important to develop and practice concentration. And those of you, I know some of you studied with me at the spring retreat on mystic relaxation, because there Murshid Hazaran Icon talks about the idea of concentration, contemplation, and then one might say almost a deconcentration, falling into a meditative state after one's used one's will to concentrate on a subject. So this is a very important practice, and why we want to stay very concentrated and focused in our practices. Prayers, meditation, wazifa, whatever we're doing, that concentration is very important, because we're making up a, we're giving these thought forms to make a complete picture. So again, on the subject of wazifa, it is according to this theory that the mystics have made mantra shastra, the science of the psychological phenomena of words. Okay. Here it also is very clear that Murshid Hazrat Inayat Khan's message is coming very much from a Hindu orientation. I'd like to remind you always of this. I know that we've made available online these teachings that Sharif Graham has given, who's the archivist for the teachings of Hazrat Inayat Khan, and he talks about that also in those lectures. Very much influenced by Hinduism. Murshid, as a child, went to a Hindu school. He wrote great hymns to Ganesh and a lot of the Hindu gods. So don't forget that. We have that in our Sufi culture. In this particular tradition, I would say. So again, the mystics have made mantra shastra the science of the psychological phenomena of words, which the Sufis called wazifa. Because for a concentration of thought, the holding of a thought in mind is not sufficient. In the first place, it is not possible for anybody, only some people can hold, it is not possible for everybody, only some people can hold a thought as a picture. Those that happen to be visual artists have this great capacity, but others that maybe are more inclined towards music, they don't see pictures in the same way. They don't visualize in the same way. So here we have another modality, another method. If there is any possibility of completing a thought, it is only by repetition. Eastern art also shows this tendency for the same reason. If a border around a wall is made of roses, it is a rose repeated 20,000 times in order that the picture of a complete rose may be had, for when one glance is cast over it. So you see it many, 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 many times, and then it becomes like a complete impression, you might say, on the mind. You understand? If there are many objects before one, no single object can be held in thought. Therefore, the best way of contemplating that the mystics adopted was to repeat a word suggestive of a certain thought, a word that caused the picture of a certain idea by its repetition. Any comments or any questions about that?
So if you do find your mind, you know, it's empty going. Just bring it back.
Bring it back. Bring it back. Bring it back.
Last one in.
Yeah. Yeah. And over time, it will stay tethered. It's part of the training. That's why we call it practice. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I thought It might be. Oh, I have. Let's see. Maybe I have something else. Yes, I want to read a couple more things, and then I want to do a practice with you because it's beautiful to experience this. A few more things. So this is from a Sufi Message, Volume 2, and we will have all these references online. By the way, we'll make sure that you see what's noted and read from, along with the recording of this class. This is on the mysticism of sound, the mystery of color and sound, by Hazrat Anait Khan. The mantra yoga of the Hindus is based on this principle. The Sufi term for this is dhikr or zikr. That is the use of words for the unfoldment of the soul. Use of words for the unfoldment of the soul. How beautiful is that? Mm. That we set up a kind of resonant vibration that opens us to that vibration, unfolding the soul. A little bit more on the same subject. Let's see. Again, this is from the same message volume, but this one is on the spiritual significance of sound and color. So this is all coming from the same volume, being said in slightly different ways. So, you know, he repeated himself and said things in a number of different ways, Hazrat Anait Khan did, to help illuminate things for us. So again, Hindus have called it mantra yoga. The Sufis have termed it wazifa. It is the power of the word which works upon each atom of the body, making it a medium of communication between the external life and the internal life. How beautiful is that? That the sound works upon every atom of the body, making a connection between the external life and the internal life. Beautiful. I mean, don't you just want to run home and start practicing right now?
Is that all languages, or?
I would say so. But we know that there are certain vibrations that have more of an effect. And I think one of the interesting contemporary experiments were by the water experiments by Dr. Umoto, where he looked at the quality of the sort of image that was made in the water based on certain sounds and certain vibrations, certain kinds of musics. Music made more harmonious, music made beautiful formations, where the hard, harsh music, aggressive music, made aberrant formations. And the same thing with certain words. Love and gratitude made the most beautiful formations, but things like hate or anger made other kinds of vibrations.
Or images. I wonder if you could say the same words with a different feeling or tone. Mm-hmm.
I think so.
So in some ways it has to go on with the
vibration.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think?
Or
energy.
Intent.
Mm-hmm. I do think it is said that the more ancient languages are more infused because the vibration has been around longer. But I do always note, and I think it's important for us to note, that some of the great 20th century thinkers, Sri Aurobindo is one of them, studied at Oxford and did all of his teachings on yoga in English. Mahatma Gandhi, of course, gave everything in English, also studied, I believe it was at Oxford, and in England. Hazrat Anait Khan, of course, gave his teachings in English. And it is said that as a boy, he had a very great yearning to learn English. And that as a child, he was a little bit of the, you know, he had a leadership as a child. So he was a little bit of the ringleader for the other children he hung out with. And so he gave them strict orders. If anyone came to the train station that was English-speaking, they were to come and get him. because he was the one that was going to offer his services to give tours, because he wanted to practice English. Now, don't you think that's interesting?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fascinating, but it's in his diaries, it's in records, and he wanted to be able to use that language. And of course, I've said it many times, I'm repeating myself, but when Murshid came to the West, even when I began international travel several decades ago, that everyone encouraged me to learn French because that was the international language. But is it? It's interesting that did he maybe know that we would be living in such a technological world? He was fascinated with technology, by the way, when he could record his own, you know, with phonographic capabilities and also broadcast through radio. And you know, really, I think it's because of the technology unfolding the way it has that we English is such a becomes such a major language for communications.
And Martin Luther King's powerful speeches were English.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so I think that I think some people got this vision that that language needed to be empowered by giving spiritual teachings in that language, because it would become a universal language. Isn't it interesting when you think about it? So. So I go back for just a moment to our original teaching for today. And Murshid says, and again, I'm reading from the Training by Abstinence. The egoistic has no capacity, for it is his ego which makes the heart, so to speak, solid. Giving no accommodation to the essence of God. And I like the example, again, that we see in some Hindu rituals where they take the coconut and they break it on the rocks, symbolic of the hard shell of the ego. And then when it breaks open, there's the soft flesh of the coconut and the milk. It's hollow inside, but it's contained that milk. And then they offer it. The egoistic has no capacity, for it is his ego which makes the heart, so to speak, solid, making no accommodation to the essence of God. The more one denies the demands of the ego, which satisfy its vanity, the more capacity one makes to be filled by the life of God. He's really given a good sales pitch here, I'm telling you. Are you ready? Ready to give up that, or transform, not necessarily give up, because there's nothing we're trying to get rid of, but it's trying to, again, control it, contain it. Look at it. Mind. So here, thinking about this divine life and light, light and life, we can use these two words, Nur and Hai. I think especially, I think Shoshita, you should be doing the practice. Hai.
Mm-hmm.
Life, life, life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Maybe, yeah. I think that's a very good one for you. I'm sorry, I shouldn't maybe say that. You can check with your own teacher.
Sounds good to me.
I think it's a good one for you to do. But this life force and Nur is this aspect of light that is the light that resides in all things, that is self-revealing. the light that is within your being, that light, that divine spark, that divine light that is constantly self-revealing, if we tune to it, and then life, divine life. Okay? Now, when we begin our Wazifa practice, the first set, we always use the word Ya, Y-A. Why do we do this? Anyone remember? What does that mean?
Is it a praise?
A kind of praise, a salutation. Oh dear one, oh beloved one, oh beloved, oh divine light, oh divine life.
And I think that because of the sound element, it opens up that
perfect.
Yeah.
Ah. Bring that in. Mm-hmm. So when we do our first set of Wazifa, which usually they're prescribed in a set of 101, so the first 34 are using this invocation, Yah. The next 34, we drop the Yah, and mm-hmm. we go to a more of a whisper. And the last 33 to complete the 101 are silently. So the vibration becomes more subtle. And if you think about it, isn't it interesting that Hazrat Anayat Khan said, heal my body, heart, and soul. Maybe we're speaking aloud. Ya Nur, Ya Hai, body. Heart. So, it's speculation, but it's a good thought to think about it then that way. It becomes more and more subtle. And in some of the previous teachings, Mercius talked about this, that it was like one layer on top of another. There I also gave the metaphor of the hard shell of the ego, the flesh. The hard shell of the coconut, the flesh of the coconut, and the milk of the coconut. You remember that teaching, perhaps. But he was talking about those three levels, and we were thinking about it like the Russian doll sometimes. Or St. Teresa of Avila talked about peeling the layers of the onion away to get to that sweet part, that nugget, the heart of the onion, which is very sweet. So a kind of, Mercia Tadayat gave us the beautiful example today of the doormat. The doormat could be very dirty and hardly feels welcoming into the home. Or it could be cleaned and clarified and even offer the words welcome. You remember he said that? It's like that. It's beautiful, simple. That's a beautiful... Sometimes his writings are extremely complex, and you know, but they're very comprehensible and accessible too. But what a beautiful example. So we're going to do this practice just a little bit. And think of it when we're calling Yanur, Yahai, that you're thinking, sometimes that quality, of course, is always in us, but we may not be able to... experience it directly. So calling aloud is like calling to a friend, perhaps, that you're seeing across the valley. And you're a little bit, hello, hello, you know? And you're calling to them. And then you somehow come to each other. And at that point, well, my goodness, it would be rude to yell at them, yes? Or to call out in such a loud way. So you speak more softly. And at that point, you're not saying, dear sir, dear madam. But you're just calling them by their name. And then finally, you know, like a good friend, then sometimes no need for words at all. Just a feeling of togetherness and understanding. And that we want to come to. and the practice can bring that alive in us. Are there questions about that? So you may want to listen and then join in. On the breath, breathing in Noor and out Hai. Divine light, divine life, light and life. Any questions or comments about the practice? Any experiences that anyone would like to share?
I've noticed this before, that when I do my wasipas in that manner, that it seems it's easier for me to concentrate on the breath.
Okay.
Than it is on the other two. That's it.
It may be that you've gone through the process, too.
So that you burst
in. No, I don't think so. I think, again, that is the very important part of concentration and contemplation. Sometimes people think meditation is something we do. Meditation isn't something we do. Meditation is a kind of state that we come to after we've done these other two things. And so that's what you're describing. You have actively been involved in the practice, and then you allow yourself to fall into the vibration. You're having the experience of exactly why we do things in the way that we do. You understand?
Mm-hmm. I do. Okay. Thank you.
So thank you for sharing it, too. I hope that can also give a different perception of as to what is happening. Is there anyone else? Okay. Back to the reading on abstinence. When the will is able to rule one's life, and not one's bodily appetites and mental fantasies, then there is a reign of the golden age, as the Hindus say. When the will is able to rule one's life, and not one's bodily appetites and mental fantasies, then there is the reign of the golden age, as the Hindus say. That control. When man finds disturbances in his life, a lack of harmony in the external life, he must take refuge under the reign within, which is the kingdom of God. When man finds disturbances in his life, a lack of harmony in external life, one must take refuge under the reign within, which is the kingdom of God. So again, we can interpret those difficulties that arise in life as a great blessing that helps carve us out. Cook the chickpea. Carve out to collect the rainwater, you see. But what happens? We're like a fish on a hook, and we want to keep fighting it. Sometimes we're learning surrender.
It sounds like sometimes we want to achieve surrender.
It's something that we can offer. Can offer that surrender and that openness. You know, it's almost some people in the realms of addiction, they talk about when people bottom out is when the true healing happens. So sometimes we have to think of it as that way too. There's another beautiful poem by Rumi, and I'll just say a line, but it's always struck me. He says, it's something like this, I'm interpreting it again. Trying to remember how it begins. It's about making great sky circles that we fight, and we try to make these great sky circles, but falling, we're given wings. I I think it's something like people make great efforts to make sky circles, but falling, we're given wings. How beautiful is that? And that's why the Sufis always give this imagery of the wine. The wine can only happen when the individual grapes are crushed and merge with all of the others. You understand? These are such beautiful teachings. They really are. They're amazing. I have to check my time. So I switch again to another reading to kind of highlight this aspect of Murshid's teaching when he says, when the will is able to rule one's life, that this is a kind of golden age. And I wanted to turn to Murshid's teachings in Sufi Message Volume 2. This is the Cosmic Language. The volume titled Cosmic Language. And I'll read a few short paragraphs because I think it again highlights, gives a bit of a commentary onto that one line, which is very potent. And this is on the subject of will. The earth holds the seed, and the result is that a plant springs out and bears fruit. So with the heart. The heart holds the seed of thought. And there also a plant springs out and brings the fruit of fulfillment. Beautiful metaphor. You know, again, Murshid was very in touch with the elemental world, and he saw it as kind of a kind of ecology, not in necessarily the way that we think of it now, but he saw the relationship of that elemental world to this internal world. And here he draws that example. The earth holds the seed, and the result is that a plant springs out and bears fruit. So the heart holds the seed of thought, and there also a plant springs out and brings the fruit of fulfillment. But it is not only the thought, it is the power of holding the thought which is of great importance. So here we're talking again about the aspect of concentration. Therefore, the factor of the heart, a factor which holds the thought. You know, if you love something, you don't have to, you know, you're just naturally thinking about it, yes? It's there all the time. So, therefore, the factor of heart, a factor which holds the thought, is of very great importance for the fulfillment of life's purpose. Therefore, the factor of heart, a factor which holds the thought, is of great importance to the fulfillment of life's purpose. I will say this also. Murshid also said that all happiness depends on the fulfillment of life's purpose. That our happiness is dependent upon the fulfillment of life's purpose, our life's purpose. Not other people, not external things. The fulfillment of our purpose, that we feel purposeful. That we feel like we're moving towards some sort of purpose and actualizing that purpose. Often a person says, I try my best, but I cannot concentrate my mind. I cannot make my mind still. It is true. But it is not true that he tries his best. Best does not end there. Best does not end there. You know that I tried my best. Really? Your best doesn't end there. That's what Merchant's telling us. I tried my best, but I cannot concentrate my mind. I cannot make my mind still. The merchant says, it is true, but it is not true that he tries his best. Best does not end there. Best really brings the purpose to its fulfillment. The mind is just like a restive horse. You were using that example. Bring a wild horse and yoke it to a carriage. It is such a strange experience. And you know, Mersha, he loved horses. He rode them. You can see him in pictures on the horse. He says, bring a wild horse and yoke it to a carriage. It is such a strange experience. For it will kick and jump and run and try to destroy that carriage. Hello? Happens inside too. It is a weight for the mind to carry when you make it take one thought and hold it for a while. It's just like that horse. We're putting the yoke and carriage on it. It is then that the mind becomes restless because it's not accustomed to discipline. So then it's making plans for the rest of the day and thinking about all the things it has to do and saying, oh, I'm so bored with these practices or whatever goes on in people's heads, including my own. I'm not above all that. You know, but I observe it and I say, well, wait a minute. What's going on today? Reel it back in. I have a good friend. Some of you know him, Genden Jatso. And his brother is a monk in Tibet. And his brother did a three-year retreat. Are you ready for this? He did a three-year retreat. Three-year retreat. That's nothing. A lot of them do that. So he comes out of his retreat, and he realizes that the whole time he was in his retreat, he was preoccupied during his practice with the thought of building a house for his parents. You know, it was like, I really want to help my parents. I want to build a house. I want to, you know, I want to get money. I want to offer my, yeah. And so he said, well, I guess I didn't do a very good retreat. I have to go back in for another 3 years. So he did, because he realized, even at that level, a very well-trained practitioner had trouble controlling his mind. So we also have to be mindful of that.
I hope he built the house first.
Well, they do have a very nice house, but I don't know that he did. I think he went into retreat. So anyway, so it is a weight for the mind to carry when we make it take one thought and hold it for a while. It is then that the mind becomes restless because it's not accustomed to discipline. Are you ready for this? Mm-hmm. There is a thought that the mind will hold by itself. Want to guess what it is? What mind does the mind? What thoughts do the mind hold by itself? You don't have to tell it to go there.
What? Om?
Oh, we wished it was Om. Diane, you're a saint if yours is Om. Anyone else? How easy the mind goes to these places?
Plus the result?
Oh, that's a good one, yeah. A thought of disappointment. A thought of pain. A thought of grief. Of sorrow or failure. We easily play those over and over and over again, yeah? We become self-obsessed with those kinds of thoughts. Well, those can be friends, too. I call them my practice buddies. When those arise, you use them. You say, well, what do I need as a balance to this? They're good reminders. If you don't let that horse carry you along, you say, oh, this is arising. I have to take control of this. And remember, when we've done practices with Jamal, the receptive and the active, there's always a balance, you see. So if there's sorrow and sadness, maybe we need some energy, maybe we need some Noor, high, divine light. Illuminate this for me. Life, give me the life force to move through it. You see, you can always kind of find a balance. Does it make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So please understand these practices are medicine. They're our medicine, our spiritual medicine. And of course, it's good for us to find, to work with our advisors, your teachers. They often can give you the right medicine. It's good to not self-prescribe in any realm, okay? So there is a thought that the mind will hold by itself, a thought of disappointment or pain or grief, of sorrow or failure. The mind will hold it so fast that you cannot take it away from its grip. The mind holds it by itself. But when you ask the mind to hold a particular thought, then the mind will not hold it. It says, I'm not your servant, sir, or I'm not your servant, madam. The mind doesn't like it. The ego. When once the mind is disciplined by concentration, by the power of will, then the mind becomes your servant. Once the mind has become your servant, then what more can you wish? Then what more can you wish? Then your world is your own. You are the king of your kingdom. Or we could also say the queen of your kingdom. Although Marshall always gave the teachings in the masculine. But that is a very high form of English, classical English, that he gave the teachings. And he wasn't, if we think about it, he was a feminist all the way. I mean, every advanced initiation he gave was to a woman. There were no Murshids. There were only Murshidas when he left us. Four Murshidas. Hmm. He gave that lineage to the women. It's a feminine ray. It really is, the messages. So don't think that Murshid just forgot about the women because he gave this only this language. So is that clear that we will? I've had some people say to me that they really have terrible time concentrating. And one of the concentrations in the Gatha is also on the Nakshabandi teachings on symbology. Murshid gives several forms to concentrate on, but a very simple one that one can do is just themselves draw a circle with a dot in the middle of it. It's that zot, or it's the bindu. And if you just concentrate, and you can use your breath, you breathe out, you concentrate on the circle. You breathe in, you concentrate on the dot. You breathe out, you concentrate on the circle. You breathe in, you concentrate on the dot. You know, the Tibetan Buddhists at least give very complex visualizations. Part of that methodology is to give the mind so much to do that it gets tired. You understand? Oh, visualize this, now see the lotus pad, now see the sun, now see the moon, now see the deity, now see the ornaments, now see the colors, now this, and now see all the deities. Or, I mean, you know, that's a terribly complex kind of thing to build. But the mind is concentrating there, so that then when the mantra arises, it can relax and fall into that vibration. You see? Good. I'm having nodding heads here, so I have agreement. I hope I have some nodding heads from afar as well. I read a little bit further. And we will be doing some practices. Are you sticking with me? Am I keeping your interest? I hope so.